Previously on Beta.
You just sit comfortably thousands of miles away from the battlefield and simply press the button.
It's Baltimore, gentlemen. The gods will not save you.
I only wrote the one chapter.
That's a hell of a chapter. Did you use really big font?
Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Today, novelist and showrunner George Pelicanos joins us to talk about reuniting with The Wire's David Simon to create the compelling miniseries We Own This City. The show explores the true story of corruption in the Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force.
They were guys who were allowed to keep doing what they were doing because they were producing.
Also, Elaine Shea Chao on her debut novel, Disorientation. It's a campus satire about a PhD student who's disenchanted with her dissertation.
I think with a lot of my Asian friends, we've talked about the fear of being fetishized and how it truly messes you up in a lot of ways.
But first, Sarah Pauley. She's an Academy Award-nominated screenwriter, director, and actor. From her start in Terry Gilliam's The Adventures of Baron Munchausen, through her work on one of Canada's top television series, Road to Avonlea, through her American breakthrough in the 1999 film Go, Sarah has enjoyed creative success at every level. Sarah's resume also includes the documentary film Stories We Tell. That project won the New York Film Critics Circle Award and the National Board of Review Award for Best Documentary. Now my fellow Canadian has switched her attention to writing with her memoir, Run Towards the Danger, Confrontations with a Body of Memory. It's a beautifully written, brave, and honest exploration of the most harrowing stories of Sarah's life. As she started writing the book, Sarah discovered that there was a dialogue happening between her past and her present.
You know, the connective tissue between these essays, because I think on the surface they're about very different things, is this moving through a past situation through a sort of current echo of it. So an experience in the present that sort of dredged up a lot of stuff from the past that ended up going a different way. And it meant that the memories that I'd been holding on to of these past, usually difficult experiences, they became more malleable. Like the memories themselves then didn't sort of stay in this fixed, hard narrative, but were able to kind of move into another state, which was really interesting to me because, you know, I'm someone who's like, I'm very interested in psychoanalysis. I'm really interested in the way our pasts inform our current lives. But I hadn't yet really discovered how much our current lives can inform our relationship to our pasts and how much current experiences or new experiences can kind of change that relationship between us and what happened to us in the past. And that's certainly what happened to me in many of the stories that I tell in this collection.
When you were 8 years old, you played Sally Salt in the Terry Gilliam film, The Adventures of Baron Munchausen. What was that experience like for you?
I mean, it was a really difficult experience, actually. I mean, there were things about it that were obviously wondrous. I mean, I got to work with some of the most talented people in the world on a beautiful film. But for a child, it was a terrifying environment to work in. I mean, there were explosives all the time. There were special effects that, you know, in those days were done manually, not with CG. We were in, you know, very cold tanks of water for very long periods of time. I worked extremely long hours. It was a really harrowing experience for everybody, you know, including the adults on that film, let alone an 8 or 9 year old.
After The Adventures of Baron Munchausen was released, you wrote a letter to the director, Terry Gilliam, about your experience working on the movie. What did you say in the letter?
So I wrote this email years later, and it was when Terry Gilliam was making another film involving a 9-year-old girl who was also happened to be Canadian, and he was shooting in Canada. And I suddenly realized, I was in my 20s at the time, that I'd never actually spoken to him directly about the impact that the experience of working on that film had been for me and how much it had kind of haunted me. And I realized, oh my God, there's another kid going to work with the same filmmaker. I owe it to this kid and also to him to say, here's what could have been different. Here's how I think you could have handled it differently. Like, here's what I think your priority should have been and what you need to watch out for. And so I wrote him a long letter just outlining my memories and what my experience was of it and how it had, I think, when I was younger, really hardened me in some way. He wrote back right away. It was actually not that defensive an email. He did take responsibility for quite a few things. He also didn't take responsibility for a lot of things. And it's not a perfect response, but probably better than a lot of people would be capable of in the circumstances. And then he also allowed me to publish that exchange in a newspaper shortly afterwards when I wrote a piece about child acting.
Mm-hmm. You're known as Canada's sweetheart in our home and native land of Canada, and that comes from your time as Sarah Stanley on the CBC show Road to Avonlea. You say that as you grew older, you came to see the show as a grave injustice. How so?
You know, I think the show is really problematic. I think that we spent a lot of years really loving these stories of this idyllic past, you know, based on Lucy Maud Montgomery's stories. And there's a lot that's beautiful in those stories. But it's also, it's become sort of this history of Canada somehow, of us looking back nostalgically at this completely innocent, all-white past where, you know, there's no mention of Indigenous people or the people who are like driven out of where they lived and the land that was theirs. There was very little diversity. And then it became even more sort of egregious, I think, when the Disney Channel bought the show and it became all about family values. You know, like the one sort of saving grace about the show was there was something about the collective and about a town. And then it suddenly became about these sort of nuclear families and sort of glorifying the family values unit. As I became a young teenager, I was becoming more and more politically active. And I couldn't reconcile my sense of the world or of the stories that I thought should be told about our country's history and what was being told in this show that I was bound to, that I was bound contractually to for years of my life. My feelings about it are more complex now because I also realize it was a show that a lot of families watched together every Sunday night. I'm very comfortable being critical of the way it portrays Canadian history, absolutely. I'm not as comfortable just sort of smashing the show in the way I used to be, because I do think there's a lot of stuff that people brought to it and that it meant for people that was important to them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very well said. You mentioned reconciliation. Did writing about your experience on Road to Avonlea, did that help you achieve some sort of reconciliation in any way?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've been thinking about this for a long time. And, you know, I've been in therapy for 23 years. And so I feel like a lot of the stuff I needed to kind of work out and parse out, I've done over many years. I think the process of living what I write about was really helpful. The process of writing about it was almost like a process of going, what am I missing here? What am I not seeing? And in a way, like that essay, in the same way that all of the essays have this kind of reflection on the past through a present lens. And actually that essay is written through the lens of going to Prince Edward Island, where that show took place or where it was set, and going with my kids and having this completely idyllic trip there and learning things about PEI's history that were fascinating to me, and really getting caught up in the magic of what that place is and what those stories used to mean to me, and seeing the island through my kids' eyes. And again, it just allowed me to kind of loosen my grip on this resentment I had, which wasn't misplaced. Like, I think it's fair to feel resentful about things that happen in your life that are wrong, but it's not a great place to stay in. It's a really good place to visit for a good long time until you've work through stuff, but I was really happy to move beyond that as well. You know, I had some terrible experiences on that show. I was stalked by a crew member for a long time. Mm-hmm. I mean, I had like some really frightening stuff happen, and my grief about my mother dying at that age was exploited for, you know, scenes in which I was crying about my mother dying. So there were things to be upset about, but it felt really good to kind of go, okay, like I've really spent a lot of time thinking about these things and talking about them and now even writing about them, but you know, look at the impact that these stories actually did have on me when I first read them when I was 9 or 10, this sense of wonder and magic. And to be able to reconnect to that as well felt like as important a part of the process as naming all of the really hard things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. One of your rawest essays is about your experience with radio host Gian Gomeshi, who was accused of sexual assault and harassment. Would you mind sharing why you wrote this essay?
I had a really hard decision to make at the time that women came forward and there was a big court case here in Canada about it. And I had to make a really hard decision about whether or not to come forward as well. And I did a lot of research about whether or not I should. And that involved talking to more than a dozen lawyers and talking to people I knew who covered this as journalists and talking to friends and family. And what I realized was, because my memories were kind of inconsistent about the event, because I had maintained not at all a romantic relationship with him, but a friendly relationship professionally with him. I'd been on his show being interviewed by him. There were all of these unbelievably awkward details that made it feel like I would not be any help to those women who came forward if I came forward too. And of course, this is what happened to the women who came forward. As in most sexual assault cases, there were lots of gaps in memories. There were lots of inconsistencies. There were lots of correspondences that they had not divulged or, in the case of Lucy Ducouture, I believe, hadn't remembered. And so that was, you know, sort of thrown at them as evidence that they must have been lying about the incident itself. But we now know this very kind of inconsistent behavior, this behavior that seems at odds with the incident that's being reported, is, you know, this is really common. This is like common and has to do with how we process trauma, how our memory processes trauma. But I kind of knew what was coming. And so I stood back. And so years later, you know, and I've been working on this essay for years and years and years because I have felt like ethically I had to tell the story at some point. And I think ultimately what I realized was important that I could say is, I am going to cross-examine myself. I'm going to show you all of the ways in which my behavior doesn't add up to behavior that seems in line with someone who has had this experience happen to them. I'm going to show you all of my consistencies, all of my lapses in my memory, all of, you know, my embarrassing emails afterwards, the cringiest moments of me being interviewed by him on his show and being like strangely obsequious almost in a way that I wouldn't be with anybody else. And I'm going to show you that as evidence that this is what it looks like. It's messy. And, you know, let's stop hurling these accusations at women who are brave enough to come forward, because this is what it actually looks like. And I do think we're coming to a more rich, fulsome understanding that this kind of behavior is normal. But I wanted to contribute to that conversation by kind of offering myself up as a case study in a way that makes me deeply uncomfortable. But it felt to me like, having not come forward at the time, which I've never felt completely at peace with, this is what I could offer to the conversation now.
Very well said. A few years ago, you suffered a serious concussion. And when you visited this doctor in Pittsburgh, he offered you the advice that became the title of your book. What did he say?
So I had a concussion for years, and I went to see Dr. Mickey Collins at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. And up until then, for the 3.5 years I'd been struggling with this head injury, you know, I had been taking various forms of the advice of either lie in a dark room for a few weeks or go and do your regular activities, but as soon as you feel a headache coming on or brain fog, rest. And then when you're ready, go back up to it. And his advice was, no, the things that are causing you discomfort are the things you have to get better at dealing with. So it's not a matter of going lying in a dark room ever, actually. Like, if you start to feel brain fog or you start to feel a headache come on, take a quick walk around the block, do this exercise we've prescribed. Now, this was all, I have to be really clear, scaffolded with very specific treatments around vestibular exercises, physical exercises. Like, I don't think this is the kind of thing everyone should just run out and do if they have a concussion. I think it's good to seek medical advice, preferably his, if you have the ability. But I think that his advice was, run towards the danger. So anything that causes you discomfort, anything that causes pain, you need to actually do more of. But it was a complete paradigm shift to say, run towards the danger, like, do the things that are hardest, do the things that are most uncomfortable. And that's the only way you're going to heal.
That's great. How do these four words, run towards the danger, how do they influence the way you live your life now?
I mean, I think it's been a paradigm shift in every part of my life. I mean, I think the writing of this book was about running towards the danger. Like, I'm telling stories here that are really hard to share, that were really hard to write, that there is a huge risk in telling. But it's something I've always wanted to do, is to write a book and to kind of be in a conversation and offer these experiences up as part of a dialogue. I was scared to make another film. I've spent 10 years home with kids, and I've had a concussion, and, you know, I didn't know if I could do it. And I made a film this year. I tend to take on tasks that in the past I've avoided. I tend to just run into experiences that I know will be uncomfortable and take those gambles, which I think in many ways I've just avoided over the years. So his advice to me went well beyond the healing of a concussion. It sort of entered into every part of my life.
That's great. Sarah Pauley, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations on Run Towards the Danger. It is a very powerful and beautifully written book.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it, and I really love your show.
Sarah Pauley is the author of Run Towards the Danger, Confrontations with a Body of Memory. She's also a screenwriter, director, and actor. You can find out more about Sarah at WPR.org/beta.
The drug war has not just destroyed neighborhoods and individuals and families, but it's ruined policing.
Coming up, George Pelicanos on reuniting with The Wire's David Simon to create the HBO miniseries, We Own This City. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, I'm not going to sit in front of you and tell you that I haven't been around some bad things. I have. But I can also tell you that these things that you think that I've done, these things that you've heard about me, they are false. Completely false. Now, is there misconduct in this department? Of course there's misconduct, but I'm not the one you want. Can I ask you a question? I'm one of the most talked about, most celebrated officers in history of this city. Do you not find it odd? And now all of a sudden I'm the mastermind of this whole thing? That doesn't strike you as weird?
They're all lying.
That's what I said.
That's actor John Bernthal in a scene from the HBO miniseries, We Own This City. He plays Sergeant Wayne Jenkins of the Baltimore Police Department's Gun Trace Task Force. The series is based on investigative journalist Justin Fenton's book, We Own This City, a true story of crimes, cops, and corruption. It's the story of the systemic problems in the department that came to light in the wake of the Freddie Gray uprising. The show was created by David Simon and George Pelicanos. David, of course, is the creator of The Wire, a fictional saga addressing some of the same themes in Baltimore. George served as one of Simon's stable of writers for The Wire, often scripting its most heartbreaking episodes. Now they return to Baltimore 20 years later to see what, if anything, has changed. George Pelicanos joins us from his home in Washington, D.C., to talk about the show and why he was interested in adapting the book for television.
Well, we both knew the story of We Own This City, which was about the GTTF, the Gun Trace Task Force. It was a big local story and became a national story. But the first thing that David and I always do is when we're deciding on these things is we sit down and ask each other, what's this about and why are we doing this? Because what is it about modern day policing? We're really going back to the beginning of the drug war that has facilitated such behavior, in other words, and encouraged such behavior. Because when you make it the mission to mass incarcerate and to mass arrest, you create this atmosphere where police break rules. You know, when I say break rules, I'm talking about unconstitutional policing, illegal stops, illegal search and seizures, because they're in the service of their bosses and the politicians who love to run on law and order and love to run on I'm tough on crime. And that's really what we wanted to talk about, all those things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Fans of The Wire are going to see a lot of familiar faces and themes in We Own This City, but this is not a coda to The Wire. How did you and David approach returning to Baltimore to tell this story, knowing that a lot of people are probably going to draw comparisons?
This is a different animal in the sense that it's entirely fact-based, and we had to stick to the facts and not veer off into conjecture. And all of the characters, except for one, are based on actual people, and we had to honor that. The Wire was rooted in reality, but it was all fictional characters. But it is, in a sense, a coda, because the Baltimore that we left 15, 20 years ago is different now. The conditions have gotten worse for the citizens. To give you an example, there was a scene in one of the Wire episodes where Herc and Carver find some money during a raid and they shove it in their vests. 20 years later, you've got police officers in reality doing home invasions, robbing citizens, and most importantly, they were confiscating drugs and selling them back out on the street. That would have been unheard of 15, 20 years ago in the police force. So in that sense, it is a coda. It's an update on what's going on in the city and by extension, what's going on in America vis-a-vis the police.
Mm-hmm. You're right, actually. That's a very good point. And it's interesting that some points of the We Own This City timeline intersect with your fictional Baltimore wireline from The Wire, don't they?
That's true. Yeah, and we go back to the beginning of Wayne Jenkins' career, which was he came out of the Academy in 2003. And I believe we started The Wire in 2002, so those timelines do intersect. You know, one of the reasons we went back to the beginning, first of all, he was the longest-serving police officer on the GTTF. And also, we wanted to show what happens to a police officer coming out of the Academy. You know, the Academy tries to teach them right. They teach them constitutional policing. They have sensitivity training. And so in the show, you know, and this really happened. The Jenkins comes out of the Academy, and they put him up with a sergeant. And the very first day, the sergeant says to him, I'm going to show you how to police. This is Baltimore.
What's the charge on that guy?
Loitering in a drug-free zone. Failure to yield, failure to obey.
What's any of that do in court?
Doesn't go to court. Pulls them off the street till they see the court commissioner in the morning, then they drop the charges. Or if the ASA cuts him loose from the jail side, then maybe he's indoors till early morning.
Well, that's a good thing.
That's what they want. Like the LT says, we clear the corners, they'll stop shooting each other. If they stop shooting each other, the murder rate goes down. And if the murder rate goes down, the mayor gets to be the governor.
And so the system sort of sabotaged these guys coming fresh out of the Academy. You know, none of these guys, we don't portray them as villains. I mean, when they started out, they wanted to be good police. And the system is what corrupted them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and they go from, like, yeah, as you say, Wayne Jenkins was considered a hero by among Baltimore Police Department members, and then he, once this is found out, he ends up becoming corrupted. Well, and he becomes an anti-hero. We here at Beta love chameleonic actors, and there are few better than John Bernthal. Besides his impressive Baltimore accent, what made John your choice to play the part of Wayne Jenkins?
Well, David and Nina Noble had worked with him before on the Yonkers show they did. Mm-hmm. And I knew he could play a tough cop. John's from Baltimore, from D.C., actually, like me. So I was a little prejudiced in favor of him for that reason. You know, we always offer the actors a way to consult with various departments, police, fire department, whoever they want. We put them, you know, they can do ride-alongs and so on. But John did everything on his own, unbeknownst to us. He contacted the police himself. He got himself embedded with these guys. He went out on raids. He did all kinds of things. Consequently, he would come to set, and we did years of research on this show, and he would come to set knowing things about Jenkins that we didn't know. You know, I would say to him, well, John, why do you got to have a lollipop in your mouth during this scene? You know, and he's like, well... Jenkins always liked this various kind, you know, this specific kind of lollipop. And one day, David, there was a courtroom scene where Jenkins was testifying in the box, and he was wearing his police vest. And David came on set, and he said, "No, you know, a police officer would never wear his vest when he's testifying." And so John Bernthal pulls out a Polaroid picture of Jenkins wearing his vest while testifying.
I wonder about the lollipop. Was that Jenkins channeling Telly Savalas as Kojak, perhaps?
Well, of course, I like to think so. Telly Savalas being one of my personal heroes, you know.
Yeah, I like to think so, too, yeah. How were Jenkins and the Gun Trace Task Force able to get away with stealing from citizens and drug dealers?
What happened after the uprising, the Freddie Gray uprising, was that the officers involved in the Freddie Gray death, were over-prosecuted by the state's attorney's office. And by the way, they're still on the force because they were never going to be convicted of what they were charged with. But there was a work slowdown in Baltimore on the police force after that. A lot of cops said, look, if I'm gonna get charged because somebody bumps their head while I'm putting them in my car, I'm just not going to get out of my car anymore. I'm not going to make arrests. But the GTTF cops kept working. They kept producing. They kept getting guns off the street. And the brass, up until 2 weeks before they were all arrested, the brass was giving them commendations and singing their praises in the police newsletters. And they were guys who were allowed to keep doing what they were doing because they were producing.
You're an earner and you work your ass off. We are always gonna protect you. But seriously, you could have been nailed. Problem is you half-assed the paperwork.
Look, I'll be honest with you. I didn't really think this was much of anything.
Look here. Always start with the attack. The threat to your safety can never be mentioned enough. Yeah. See, it has to seem standard to anyone looking at this that you and any other officers were in serious danger.
I know.
Guns in the city are a very important component of controlling violent crime. So they had a big responsibility. And they put the most productive, gung-ho guys on that squad. And that's the kind of guys they put on that squad. There's all kinds of plainclothes squads in the city. Jenkins had worked in many of them, VCID, violent crimes. And he worked with Sean Souter many years before, which is a big part of the storyline in the show, the tragedy of Sean Souter, which we can talk about if you'd like.
Most definitely. That was actually my next question. And you set it up, teed it up very nicely for us. Thank you. Yeah, this Detective Sean Souter storyline, he crossed paths with Jenkins early in their careers. And if you had made up Sean's story, made that arc up for a fiction series or a novel, it would feel too scripted. Can you tell us a little bit about Sean Souter?
Yeah, Sean had come up through the ranks. He was patrol and then plainclothes units. And he eventually became a homicide cop. And by all accounts, he was a good one. And when these guys were arrested, he got called in by the FBI, the task force, and they said, we need you to testify at a grand jury. And although Sean never served on the GTTF and he wasn't with those guys, one of the GTTF guys who knew him back in the day said that Sean Souter took money here and there. So what happened was Sean went in and they told him, you know, you're going to have to testify about what you know from back in the day with Jenkins and that kind of thing. And Sean Souter knew that under oath he would have to tell the truth and that he was going to lose his job because of it. And so the day before his grand jury testimony, he was killed by gunfire in a vacant lot.
Right, go, go, go!
I didn't see anyone.
The shooter!
I got here so fast, man. I could see the gun smoke above from where he was laying. I didn't see anybody.
But you heard the shots.
I heard three, maybe four shots. One of them might have been an echo. He shouted, "Stop police!" Then the shots. His leg was still moving when I got here, man. I was just coming from the corner. So I was here within 3 to 4 seconds.
Where was the gun?
Under his right shoulder.
I'm hesitant to say anything else about it because there's two schools of thought in Baltimore, and there always will be. Nobody was in that lot. Nobody saw the shooting. It's a more dramatic story to say that he was assassinated before his grand jury testimony. And then there's other people who think that he committed suicide and made it look like a murder because if you do commit suicide, your family doesn't get your pension. Any way you look at it, it was a tragedy because Sean Souter was not in league with these guys and his death shook the city.
Yeah. Winnie Misaku plays Nicole Steele, and she's an attorney who works for the Civil Rights Office of the DOJ. It seems to me that she kind of serves as the moral conscience of this series. Can you share the inspiration behind this character?
Yes. Winnie plays Nicole Steele, who's a composite character of the Civil Rights Division of the DOJ, those people who came to town and wrote a report and then a consent decree. And the reason we whittled it down to one character is we wanted to have somebody who would be the eyes for the audience. In other words, somebody who's coming into Baltimore with fresh eyes and seeing all this stuff as the audience is seeing it. And Wumi was a good choice. You might not know this, but she's British. She has a very heavy British accent. And you wouldn't know it from watching the show. And her role was difficult in that, you know, some of the hardest acting parts are the ones that are not showy. She really, a lot of her scenes are just listening to people. And it really wasn't until we got into the editing room that I saw how good she was, because that's tough to convey, you know, emotion just by listening and things of that nature. It's in her eyes, and she's a very good actress.
Yeah, very good indeed, and excellent. Excellent choice. You mentioned just a second ago a consent decree, and that comes up a lot, this idea of a consent decree throughout the series. Can you explain what a consent decree is?
Well, it's basically when the feds come in to town and they hold the city's feet to the fire in terms of reform, things like body cameras and that sort of thing. what they have as their ace card is withholding federal funds to the city if the city doesn't comply. For the most part, the police brass welcome it because it kind of takes the pressure off of them to do the things that, need to be done. The problem is that the consent decrees can't go far enough. And the reason that they can't is they don't change the mission. And that's the problem, is the mission is flawed. And it's the thesis of the show.
You're asking me what happens if the police don't want to change?
No, I'm saying that we are the people the police department hunts and kills and captures. And you are bringing me a piece of paper that says there's going to be new rules on how they can hunt us?
The drug war has not just destroyed neighborhoods and individuals and families, but it's ruined policing. Police can't operate effectively to get violent criminals off the street when citizens won't talk to them anymore. And the reason they won't talk to them is they've had brothers and sisters and fathers and uncles and cousins who have all gone to jail for nonviolent drug offenses, and they've stopped talking to the police. So the show is really our continuing argument. It's the last nail in the coffin for the drug war.
Yeah. Baltimore has averaged more than 300 murders a year since 2015, and the city is one of the most violent major cities in the U.S. What do you think could be done to change this?
There's always going to be violence in cities. I'm in D.C. We've got a spike right now in violent crimes and carjackings and that kind of thing. There's a lot of reasons for that. In Baltimore, which is something we talked about going back to The Wire, is that the end of working class jobs has cast a shadow over the whole city. If people live in poverty and have no chance to pull themselves up, there's going to be crime. Until that's addressed, there's always going to be problems. You know, when we went back to shoot this and we shot in some of the same neighborhoods we shot in 20 years ago, it was really distressing to see that the physical neighborhoods, the blocks, hadn't changed. The same plywood was in the windows of those same houses. And when you see that graphically like that, you sort of understand that why the situation not only has not really changed, it's gotten worse. On the other hand, we really love the people that we meet in Baltimore. They come out of their houses and talk to us while we're shooting. We listen, we have a good dialogue, and they love their hometown. So I don't want to make it sound like there's no hope. There's always hope, and the people are going to be the ones that bring it around.
Mm, yeah, and as you mentioned earlier, the people not talking to the police, that would hopefully change, and that might...
It's a big one.
Yeah, that's a huge one that would help make things better. George Pelikonis, thank you very much for joining us. Congratulations to you, David Simon, and everyone else who worked on We Own This City. It's a really powerful, great, important miniseries.
Great to talk to you. Thanks a lot.
George Pelikonis is the co-executive producer of the HBO miniseries We Own This City. You can find out more about George and We Own This City at wpr.org/beta.
I was so afraid of being stereotyped, and I really had like a chip on my shoulder to say, you know, don't limit me. I can write about whatever I want.
Coming up, novelist Elaine Shay Chao on her debut novel, Disorientation. I'm Doug Gordon. You're listening to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hi, I'm Doug Gordon. Welcome back to Beta from Wisconsin Public Radio.
On September 9th, Ingrid Yang could be found cramped over a desk, left foot asleep, right hand swollen. She had Chow and Chow on the mind, so much so she felt his allusions and alliterations leaking from her every orifice and puddling beneath her. She was sucking on the ends of her hair, then sniffing the damp locks, before picking at the eczema patches on her ankles. Her aching eyes were marbled pink from a sleepless night, punctuated by unnecessary trips to the bathroom. She simply idled on the toilet with her eyes closed, nothing going out of or into her body. Even on the rare occasions sleep visited, Ingrid was plagued by a constant pinching pain in her stomach. Sometimes she imagined, hopefully, that she was developing ulcers. No one could fault her for failing her dissertation because of her stomach ulcers, could they? Pneumonia then? What about mono? But how to contract these illnesses was another question entirely. The black market was the obvious choice, but then again, so was an undergrad frat party. Pulling her laptop close, she searched fastest way to contract mono, followed by top 10 deathly illnesses. No, Ingrid Yang was not doing well.
That's Elaine Shea Chow reading the opening of her debut novel, Disorientation. The book is about a 29-year-old PhD student named Ingrid Yang, who is having a lot of trouble finishing her dissertation. Like her protagonist, Elaine was in a similar situation, struggling with her own PhD dissertation. Unlike Ingrid, Elaine was in Paris when the 2015 terrorist attacks happened. This experience pushed Elaine to confront the question, if she were to die, what would she wish she had done with her life? She thought back to her childhood when she would write stories and poems. So she left her PhD program and Paris. Fast forward 7 years, and Elaine has published a very funny and socially relevant campus satire.
When I started writing the novel, I think setting in academia was a way for me to, I guess it was familiar territory, right? Because writing a novel is so daunting, and obviously I had never written one before and did not know how to go about it. So I think academia gave me a way to transition. And yeah, the things I wanted to talk about, I felt like academia was provided a good setting where I could explore those ideas.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about your protagonist, Ingrid Yang. She's a Taiwanese-American woman who's trying to finish her dissertation. What is her dissertation about?
Yeah, it's about a poet named Xiaowen Chao. He's America's most famous poet in this world, so he's, you know, fictional. He's sort of described as the Chinese Robert Frost, and his poetry, I think, is very appealing to white Americans because it just presents the East and China in the way they want to understand it, as exotified and very distant, where they don't feel implicated. So he writes poems about teacups and rivers and things like that. She has no real interest in him. You know, she was basically coerced into studying him. So because of that, and the fact that he's been truly, you know, over-researched, she doesn't know what to say and has been struggling for 4 years.
As you mentioned, writing this dissertation is a real challenge for Ingrid because she never really wanted to research Chow in the first place. So how did this happen? Was she just pressured by an advisor to write about Chow?
Yeah, exactly. So her advisor, Michael Bartholomew, she's introduced to him, I think, very purposefully because the university understood what kind of Asian American student she was. And Michael basically takes this opportunity to scare her in a lot of ways to researching him, because it's in his interest, as we find out later in the novel, for Xiaowen Chao to continue being America's greatest Chinese American poet. And in order to do this, you know, students have to keep researching him, keep him relevant. So he basically frightens her and says she'll never get a job doing anything else. If she wants tenure, researching someone canonical like Chow is the only way. And he tells this story about how adjuncting without health insurance is so horrifying, and how his student pulled out her own molar because she didn't have dental insurance. That's how she ends up researching this poet she truly has no interest in.
Yeah. Ingrid's fiancé, Stephen Green, is white, and Ingrid has this complicated relationship with white men. Can you tell us about that?
She has only ever dated white men, and that's something she has to unpack throughout the novel. It's such a hard subject for her that it takes a long time for her to even admit that, and she only really does it sort of subconsciously in this feverish dream she has. But She basically finds out that Steven, her fiancé of 5 years, has a secret folder where he stores photos of all his Asian ex-girlfriends. And this throws her into turmoil because she had not known about his inordinate, you know, obsession with Asian women. And it throws their entire relationship into question because now she has to ask herself, oh, do you actually love me for who I am on the inside? Or do you really see me as a set of interchangeable parts, these, you know, reducing me down to these traits that are found in millions of other women? And, you know, did you just sort of choose me by chance? So she really spirals down, having to live with this doubt and ask herself, can I stay in a relationship where doubt has now entered? It was important for me to explore this type of relationship that is very ubiquitous. And I think with a lot of my Asian friends, we've talked about the fear of being fetishized and how it truly messes you up in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine that would be the case. Ingrid has these very nuanced relationships with her best friend, Eunice Kim, and her nemesis, Vivian Vo. How do these characters interact with each other?
Yeah, I love Eunice and Vivian. People have referred to them as sort of the trifecta of Asian women in the novel, which I love so much. I wrote 3 versions of the novel, and Vivian and Eunice only appeared in this last version, and I realize now how necessary they are because I think it is important to show, in a way, there's sort of different facets of who Ingrid could be, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's say Ingrid, if she became radicalized now that she's starting to understand things more, she could become a Vivian. Or with Eunice, I think Eunice is more concerned with just enjoying her life. And she's not as sort of anxious and paranoid and existential as Ingrid. And so she's like, listen, I know we live in a bad system, but I'm going to have fun while I'm here. And I think if Ingrid were less anxious, more chill, she could be like Eunice and be quite happy. It was important for me to have these different Asian female characters, also with very different politics. It was just important to show we're obviously not a monolith. We come with all different backgrounds and beliefs, and often they jar against each other.
You said that you had to work through things before you could write Asian characters the way you do now. How mm-hmm. so?
Right. So when I was in undergrad, and that was the first time I took creative writing as an elective, and so to me, it was just, oh, this is like a fun class. But in retrospect, I realized, oh, every single one of my characters, without fail, were all white. And a lot of it was I was trying to copy what I was being taught. So the writers we would read in class that were very revered were, you know, Raymond Carver, of course, Flannery O'Connor, James Joyce's short stories. It was just, they were people very unlike me. I guess I didn't even understand how to take what I was learning in class and apply it to my own life. It was just like, oh, well, I will now write a short story about rural poor white people. and that's what I was doing. And I think I realized, I was like, oh, this must be working because my teachers would really like it. I think purely because I just learned the beats of, oh, this is what is thought of as great American literature. I think at that age, I think I would have felt too afraid to write about people like me and stories that are similar to my own life. I think because I didn't want to draw attention to being Asian in a way, or I was so afraid of being stereotyped, and I really had like a chip on my shoulder to say, you know, I don't limit me. I can write about whatever I want. Because I did feel even then that this expectation that if that sort of the only thing I could write was something like the Joy Luck Club. I think because that had been foisted on me, I just really had no interest in Asian American literature and thought it was all like that. it took me a long time to learn that and to unlearn these, you know, certain fears I had. So now it's a total 180, whereas before I was just writing rural white characters. Now I'm like in every story I write, I mean, the main characters are always Asian or Asian American. And I finally discovered that's what I meant to write. And I needed to carve out that path. And it definitely took a long time.
Yeah. You recently wrote an essay for the website, The Cut, that went viral. Mm-hmm. You tweeted that it was the hardest thing you've ever written and that it took mm-hmm. you 4 years to finish. Can you tell mm-hmm. us a bit about it?
Sure. Yeah. Thank you for mentioning it. The very first iteration of it in 2015, when I basically fell into this online rabbit hole and I was discovering these truly terrifying forums and blogs where white men would just discuss Asian women. It was as if we didn't really exist. Like they were so open without fear of ever being, I think, found out that the honesty was brutal. Because it's anonymous, right? The internet, like none of them are using their real names. And then there was another link to this website that just collected news articles of murders, of specifically white men murdering Asian women. Most of the time they were not strangers, right? So they were either girlfriends, wives, or they were seeing sex workers. So I became haunted by that, deeply haunted, was even like physically unwell from reading all the murders. And the first iteration of the essay is just these men speaking for themselves. So I would copy and paste their words exactly. I wouldn't change a thing. And then I would just put a summary of the murder, a murder. And then it was back and forth, you know, summary, quotation for 18 pages. And rightly so, you know, I did try to submit it, but rightly so, editors were like, we cannot publish this. You know, it's incredibly violent, that version. It's incredibly triggering to read. I didn't know what to do with it, but I knew there was a connection, right? And I knew I needed that it was so important because this was about life and death, right? This was about my survival. And I started writing again in March 2021 after the Atlanta shootings, where for the first time, you know, because in the first version, I wasn't putting my words into the piece really. But now I feel like I had some distance, and the shootings, it just confirmed this feeling like I was being gaslit. Because in 2018, I did have this feeling of, why does no one care? You know, I'm trying to tell you this phenomenon, this intersection of violence and fetishization exists, but why is no one listening? And then I think in 2021, I was like, oh, okay, I think some people are starting to see this. And so I started writing. But I think that material, it was so dark, I honestly, and emotional for me to read, that I didn't even read again what I wrote. Finally, I started working on the essay, really trying to build it into an essay when I had distance from it in like November last year. And then the essay actually kept evolving some more because there were more attacks against Asian women. That's how it took 4 years.
What is next for you?
Well, I have a short story collection that is also coming out from Penguin Press. I think it'll be great for readers to see me writing in different genres, because there's a lot of speculative stories, actually. There's like a fairy tale, there's a horror story, like a futuristic sci-fi story. So because I really do love writing in different genres, I'm excited to work on that again and also show I don't just write, you know, campus satires. I like to dabble in many things. But yeah, that's what's on the horizon.
Excellent. Well, I'm looking forward to that. Elaine Shea Chow, thank you very much for joining us, and congratulations on Disorientation. It's a wonderful debut novel. Hard to believe it's a debut novel.
Oh, that's so kind, Doug. Thanks so much for talking with me and of course for just reading and enjoying the novel.
Elaine Shea Chow is the author of Disorientation, Find out more at WPR.org/beta. Well, that does it for this edition of Beta. Thanks to our guests, Sarah Pauly, George Pelicanos, and Elaine Shea Chow. If you want to hear it again or catch up on past episodes, click over to Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast catcher and click subscribe, follow, and like. And you can keep up with us during the week online at WPR.org/beta or on Twitter at WPRBeta.
Even for the internet, it's pretty shocking.
Beta is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Red Meat Productions.
Fantastic.
Our music and technical director is Steve Gotcher.
What kind of rapping name is Steve? Steve.
Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich.
Wonderful. You're very clever, Adam.
And thanks to you, our alphas. More Beta comes your way next week. Until then, I'm Doug Gordon.
I'm Doug, and I can't be locked in a cage like some sort of manimal.